Good morning, everyone. Good morning. So first question I have is, how did the assignment go? So I have a question going forward. I still want to give you all weekly assignments, but I understand some of you are some of you have a number of other things you're trying to juggle during this time. So one thing I can do is I want to keep them due every week, but I can give out extensions liberally. But I can only give out extensions liberally if I don't put up solutions. So there's a bit of a conflict. I can't go over the solutions, I can't talk about them, I can't put them up if I give you additional time. Because really, from my perspective, I just need you to finish all the assignments by the end of the term, and we need to make sure we go through them because, that's why I'm there. I think it's better for you to keep up with them, and if you just try doing them all at once, I think you'll get overwhelmed. So I think it's better to spread out, but I do understand that sometimes you'll want a bit more time. So would you like me to delay putting up solutions if it can lead to being more flexible when you turn them in, or?
How much of the delay? Because you kind of, assignments, the podium is long.
Well, that's what I'm saying is I was thinking of putting them up sooner. And that's what I was wondering is let's say I only put up the solutions on the following Monday, for example. Does that seem, yes?
I don't know if it's possible, but maybe if we just got all the assignments today, then we could read through them and then the due dates would stay the same.
I'm working on getting the assignments up, but I'm still developing them. Like, for example, assignment 7, which is up now, if you looked, there was a first version up on Wednesday. Actually, I think maybe Tuesday even. I think I had a first version up. But it changed a lot by the time I got finished with it Thursday. In particular, I realized that I had you coding things, but I didn't have much in the way of questions that would work for the final exam. I didn't actually have you going through the code and saying, well, what does this do? So those questions are there now. So I have two more assignments to create now. So I actually hope to get them done within the next week. So they should be posted. But I'm more talking about solutions, not questions. So what I can say is that I want them still due on Wednesday. I will grant extensions, if you ask, until basically to the end of Sunday. Does that seem good? Fair enough?
Okay. I have to look at how the dates work for the last one.
I'm not sure, but you should ask if you want more time. They still want there to be a little bit of a barrier, so you try to actually get it done on time, because I don't want you to get behind.
Do you want us to individually request the extension?
Yes. I prefer for you to request the extension, otherwise I reserve the right to start taking off marks if you turn them late. If you ask for an extension, you won't get any penalty. So, because I kind of think of this as that it's okay. In real life, deadlines slip. Especially in software. But when it slips, you shouldn't just say, oh, it slipped. Oh, look. You should say, I'm going to need more time. And you tell people and be accountable for it. So, ask. Does that seem fair? Okay. So, Does anyone want still more time for assignment 6? Have you not turned it in? I assume you've all turned it in by this point. Okay, so I can talk about it. So any questions? The reason why I'm particularly asking this now is because I looked at assignment 7 and the way it came out, and it's a bit longer than I was expecting.
So it might be sure to give it some time. But question about assignment six, anything that I can go through the answers later. I'll put the solution up over the weekend. With any questions that seem particularly hard, I didn't think that assignment was that bad. It just was a pain to code some of it. Right, the...
Does the final have coding?
You'll have to read code. So you'll notice in these later assignments, I'm going to be putting a lot more code on the assignments of things that you're going to have to play with them. Like, for example, this assignment 7, you've got Linux kernel modules. And one of the things I want you to learn is how does kernel code look different from user space code? And there's a few, it's C code, but there's a few weirdnesses about programming in the kernel. So that's why I'm going to ask you part. And I'll talk about that some in a little bit. But assignment 6, any questions that really kind of stuck with you? Just straightforward. Yes? The last question was fun. I think some people were. So the last question was, that was the coding one. I think I gave you one coding one.
What?
Oh, no, right, the last thing, last one. But the last one was, what was the coding?
Oh, right, yes,
doing implementing your own tail. That's your solution shouldn't have had that many lines of code, but how big were your solutions? How big did they come out? 80? Yeah, exactly. So 80, you know, order 100 lines of code, right? You know, plus or minus, depending on how fancy you were. But it's, you know, you've got to keep track of things. Okay, you're reading this block of text. Okay, now you got to loop through it. Where are the backslash ends? Okay, are they there? Okay, no, I've got this many. Do I need more? Okay, let's read another block. So it's, there's some trickiness, certainly. But that's the funny thing about programming. You know, the difficulty of programming that you just did in those little assignments is basically as hard as programming is. Programming can get a bit harder in this, but in the small, that's basically it. You have these little puzzles where you come up with little solutions, and you have to make sure you think through the cases, and you do that. But why is programming actually hard? It's because it's not just one of those little problems. You have dozens, you know, or hundreds or thousands of these little problems that you have to then all connect together. And when you connect them together, then you get these bigger problems, which are actually, the amount of code you're at any time playing with is about order 100 lines, because that's a function, right? You know, a function, a couple of functions, and at most, you really don't want functions to be larger than that, you can avoid it. But then fitting all those pieces together and thinking of those higher abstractions. So puzzles on top of puzzles. I hope you like those kind of puzzles by now, because you're kind of going into that direction. Right? You're in third year.
Like, you should have failed before this.
Although it's funny, being a, I really enjoy putting together. It takes me time, but I do enjoy putting together things like this, because this is the only time I get to program. Which is kind of funny if you think it's a CS prop. You're like, oh, you program all the time. No, I don't. I get up here and talk to you all the time. And I get up and talk to students all the time, or I write papers all the time. They give my students instructions or talk with them and say, okay, so how is your coding going? And maybe I help them debug their code or something, look at it, but I spend very little of my time programming, which in some ways is kind of bad, but it suits me given my interests. But it's something to keep in mind as you go in your technical career is actually most computer science related jobs start off with lots of programming, and as you become more senior, you do less and less. Yeah, really. Is this like news to you?
Huh?
Yeah, it's like you program for a while, and then you typically go into management, and you tell other programmers what to do. And when you tell other programmers what to do, you're not writing the code. You might check their code, you might look at their tests and look at results, but you're thinking at higher level abstraction. In a sense, you're programming the programmers. Which brings in all kinds of other runtime and issues. Anyway, let's on to the material you're going to need to do well on these on this assignment. So, block devices and character devices. So, block and character devices come from the idea that you have Unix wants to make everything a file. Didn't do it all the way, but that was the original design, was everything was supposed to be a file. So if everything is a file, how do you interact with things that are not files? How do you talk to the user? How do you talk to the disk? How do you talk to video? How do you just deal with all this thing that we call input-output, things outside the computer? How do you talk to them? Well, the Unix idea was turn them into files. But they're not regular files anymore. They're special files. Yeah. So these are examples. They genuinely all called special files. And the special files, the two main ones, well, there's also the FIFOs. But those aren't device, those aren't device associated. The block and the character ones are used for abstracting different kinds of devices. So in the lab, you'll be dealing with character devices. In the, when you're dealing with the file systems, you are effectively using a loop device. The loopback device is a block device. Any hard disk you use, like when it says like SDA or something on a Linux box, that's a block device. So what I was trying to get is, why are there block devices and why are there character devices? Why not just have one kind of special file? There's clearly some semantic difference for having these two different abstractions. Now, one thing you can think of this as is character devices you access character by character. Block devices you access block by block. So that's one way of thinking. So it's about the size of what you're trying to access. But that's not really true. Even though that's true in practice, but you can have character devices that actually like blocks. Like, for example, tape drives actually operate in terms of blocks. But they're often abstracted as character devices. And increasingly, block devices are like things like flash memory. And flash memory is byte addressable in many ways, and actually there's no reason you couldn't have a RAM-like interface. So why couldn't you have it access character by character? What is this block thing? So while it's roughly true that you access these things in that different way, but that's not really the difference between the block and the character devices. The real difference is caching. Do you put an E when you say caching?
I don't think so.
Yes, I got the. When you have a block device, the normal assumption is that the kernel caches the blocks. With character devices, the kernel doesn't cache the results. I mean, it may buffer the results in the sense of it may read in a bit more data, it may write out a bit more data, but it never holds on to it long term. Like you don't say, so if you For example, if you were thinking of a tape and it was as a character device, you might read some data in one part of the tape, then read some data in another part of the tape. It won't remember the old data. It won't assume that you're going to go back and read that data again. With a hard disk, you load a file, the kernel is going to remember the file for a while because you might access it again. Like if you just access the first few bytes of the file, maybe it access other bytes. Well, it'll load it, so it'll keep more of the file in memory. Or it might say, okay, you've read through it once, maybe you'll read through it again. Now, you can give instructions to this and say, I don't want to cache other things, but the default behavior is for it to try to cache files in RAM. Mm-hmm.
So with blocks, so does it determine
whether you want to cache? So,
So in practice, what this means is you use block devices for persistent storage. For persistent storage that you're going to access in file system-like ways. So really, almost always, when you have a block device, it's got a file system. And otherwise, it's a character device. And you want, and so really, the block device is the file system storage abstraction.
Does it have anything to do with the distance it is from the device from the CPU?
No.
No?
No, no.
Everything's distant in some sense. Close in other sense. It's nothing to do with distance. I mean, there's always buses and things. We haven't really talked about all the different ways you can interconnect things inside the computer. You know, PCI buses, you know, Thunderbolts or whatever. I mean, these, they're just different interconnects for exchanging data. At the level at which we're operating, you know, you don't even care. I mean, we don't even see that.
Mm-hmm. How does it know? No, it won't necessarily be cached for long term. I mean, it could easily be something that you, like for example, let's say you're watching a video file. You're streaming through the file. So, no, but no, it's on a file system. So, you don't want to cache the video, but the video is stored on persistent storage. So what I'm saying is that the block devices are used for devices where you want to have, well, basically are persistent storage. They're persistent stores, and since they are persistent stores, they are slow relative to RAM. So you, if something's slow relative to RAM and you want to access it, you potentially want a caching mechanism in between. You don't necessarily want to use it all the time, but you want a caching mechanism because you're going to cache it sometimes.
There's a whole infrastructure on top of block devices. There's caching at the block level, caching at the file system level. There's all this infrastructure on top of block devices to make them function well. Character devices, you're talking to the device. You're sending bytes back and forth. That's basically what you're doing. So when you use a character device, you want to talk to the device. You use a block device, there's the stack of abstractions on top of it in order to manage it. You know, you've got block layer caching, file system layer caching, and how these are all organized depend upon exactly how the system's architected. But that's the thing, and different, you know, Unix-like kernels will do this in different ways. And in fact, this is an area that changes over time. Because this is very tied with how do you cache things? I mean, you don't want to just remember stuff because you run out of RAM. And also, what about memory map files and something? There's all this complex interaction that if you really start understanding how modern operating system kernels work, you're going to... I'm getting a little bit of feedback, aren't you? I'm just going to turn it down a little bit here. Is that okay? Or too quiet? Okay. Well, the main thing is I just want to make sure that it's even for the recording. Okay, let's try that and try that. A different? Okay, anyway, let's keep going. So, you want to... When you look at modern operating system design and implementation, you look at how things work, where's a lot of the code complexity? Where's a lot of the effort spent? It's in figuring out how to do caching right. How do you take things coming from these persistent stores and manage that? And how do you manage that with respect to the RAM demands of the running programs? Older versions of the Linux kernel used to have completely separate caches for file contents and for running processes. That memory was completely separate. Newer versions of the kernel unify. What happens because we overlap between them.
this is the sort of thing you won't see as a user space programmer. But if you're trying to work inside the kernel, this sort of stuff messes with you. They do things like implement like 10 different memory allocators for how you access storage. If you think about it, allocating RAM inside the kernel is a tricky thing. I'll talk more about that, but it's not as simple as you would think.
So there's block devices, there's character devices. On top of block devices, you normally layer a file system or so since block devices are normally used for file systems, there's all this, there's a stack of abstractions that go all the way from the block device all the way up to the to whatever file system the cache is.
We're not going to talk, the tutorial today is not about block devices, but from user space, actually block devices and character devices look very similar. When you're in kernel land, I actually was thinking of assigning you a block device. I had some sample ones, but I realized that it got kind of hairy really fast, the number of things you had to do. So instead of doing block devices in the kernel, we're going to do user space file systems. So you get the, I more care about you learning all the abstractions of how you implement a file system, and you can do it from user space, and you don't have to worry about all the kernel weirdness. And actually, all the things you learn, you could then use those exact concepts inside the kernel. It's just really a kernel API that's exposed. But that's for this week, we're talking about character devices and special devices. And so how do you know a file is special? So one thing I realize I have not talked about enough is this notion of an inode. This is the central concept in Unix file systems. It's not present in all file systems. Older file systems like FAT32 or something don't so much have this, but Unix file systems are based around inodes. So you could say inode, you could say this is the internal name, so every inode in a file system has an inode number. This is the when you talk about what is the contents of the file, you have your name. That's the name, that's your name of a file. But for the actual storage, the name of the contents of the file is this internally assigned unique identifier called an inode. Every inode, and so the inode is the data structure that describes the contents of a file. And the inode number is its name. And so when you talk about a directory is just a table for associating file names with inodes. That's it. I say a file link to inode mapping because it depends on how the file system is implemented and how that pointer is done. But that's what a directory is. So you have this level of indirection. You have the name of a file, you go to this thing in between, and then from this you get to the contents. So if this is the structure, what's in the inode?
So what's an Oneida?
What? We're in a file system. So if it's contents of the file, there must be some sort of pointers to blocks.
Yeah, that's kind of the most important thing, right?
Where's the data for the file? It's in some number of blocks. Which blocks? Well, the IDO tells you. How you represent that varies between file systems.
This might be individuals.
You either point to individual blocks, or more commonly nowadays, you point to ranges of blocks. A range of blocks is an extent. More efficient to say beginning and end is this range of blocks, this, but you have to deal with issues of fragmentation.
So there's always a trade-off between having individual pointers. So you might say, well, if I have individual pointers, how do I store very large blocks, very large files, and very small files? Because what's the size of an inode?
How much space does it take up? Is it, well, first off, do you think the size is variable? No. It's got to be stored on the disk.
So it's the size of a block. So when you say the size, well, in principle, it can vary between file systems.
But normally, any data structure, it, you know, the components of the data structure are going to have to fit into the unit of storage of the device. Now, what you may have is you may do a multiple of it. So for example, your underlying device might store, have 512 byte or 1K blocks, but your file system might have 4K or 8K blocks. So that just means that everything, it just multiplies by 4, multiplies by 8 or whatever, and treats that, but it's all evenly divisible with powers of 2, so you just access things like that. No, you don't, because you can't have variable storage, variable size structures easily stored. If you want to do something that requires multiple blocks, you have to have a block and then have pointers or references to other blocks. So you're right. This, if you have pointers to data blocks, you have to have some scheme whereby you don't just where you can efficiently point to small files. But if it's a big file, you're not going to be able to refer to all the blocks directly.
But in the book, they talk about
they have
pointers. Yep. So do the, like, whatever the pointers you have, the inode, do they count as part of the size? Or
that, the, so what happens is the inode is the root of the feature. And you have other blocks that store the input.
Those ones don't count as, like, the size of that.
I'm saying is they're part of the inode. I'm saying what you do is you just have the top part of the tree stuck in the inode. So if your tree is very shallow, you don't need any other blocks or pointers. But if it's big, then you have to... So what you do is you get this... You'll have this inode. So this will be the inode. And then it will point to some number... This is kind of the classic kind of Unix thing. You have blocks. So these are data blocks. We'll say this is data. But I only have, this is a fixed size. I only have so many of these pointers. So what do? I designate some of them as having more pointers. And these can point to data blocks. So this is known as an indirect node. This is kind of a classic Unix thing, is that you have your direct blocks and your indirect data blocks, and you have double indirect. So what you normally do is you have so many slots, maybe like 10 or 20 or whatever slots here, and the last couple are reserved for these indirect blocks. Exactly. So
So if I have a small file, I'll just use these blocks and I'll point directly to them. If it's a bigger file, I'll use this. And then maybe it's a really big file, I'll have to, these will all point to pointer blocks and those will all go. Or maybe three. It's like I can make this tree as deep as I want. Now, the trouble with this tree thing is that it's inefficient in the sense of, I have to make sure I put these data blocks in contiguous regions. If I don't do that, file access can be very inefficient. Actually, this kind of data structure is perfectly fine for an SSD. It's not good for a spinning disk. But if you're doing this, but if you're doing them in contiguous things, why am I wasting all this time pointing them individually? Why don't I point them array? That's where extent-based file systems come. Extent-based file systems are harder to build because you now have to worry about, well, how do I get a long array? How do I make sure I keep these extents around? So the data structure can be more compact, but it makes the logic of getting the data structure more complex. That's why older Unix systems did not do extents in newer ones. This all make sense? So, if you look at the book, it has some nice, diagrams and things. And actually, there's a really nice, I don't know if I have time to go through it in class, but there's a really nice discussion of the Berkeley Fast File System. And that's one of the first file systems that was really optimized for spinning disks and how to access them efficiently. And so it has all these tricks to make sure that when you access the data for a file, the blocks for that file will be put in contiguous range. So it's worth spending some time if you're worrying about like how is this actually organized? How do they actually put these blocks? The book has a great treatment on that. Go ahead and read that. I'm not going to test you on the details of exactly how it works. What I do want you to remember, though, is this basic idea that, okay, part of this I know is referring to data blocks or pointers to data blocks in some form, some sort of. But is that it? Is that all that's in an IDO? What else do you want? Your basic rule, whenever you have data structures or storing data, especially storing data persistently, is you have the actual data, and then you need metadata. Metadata is data about data. So inodes store metadata about the data in the file. So what sort of metadata do you want about a file? Yeah.
Owner. In Unix terms, it could be very complex. Metadata for files, you start with XML and schemas. You can have all kinds of crazy things for storing metadata. But for a Unix file system, the metadata is relatively simple. Like, what's the file's owner? It's the group. Permissions. Length,
size, but I think maybe size. Shorter word. So, okay, now this might seem a little weird. We feel, okay, owner, okay, who owns a file? What group is it part of? What are the permissions? This is the classic Unix metadata about a file. Why do I need the size? You should know this by now. Because you don't know the length of the file otherwise. Because when you're doing your allocation, this isn't in byte level boundary. This is in block storage. So you could have what happens if you have a file that's 27 bytes long? How much space is going to be allocated? Typically, it'll get 4K or 8K or something. You'll have a much larger storage. So how do you know it's only 27 bytes? How do you know the rest of the bytes in the file are not valid?
Unix doesn't use end of file characters. They're binary clean.
So you have to know how long it is. So that's what the inode tells you, how long the file is. So it's to tell you, this is how many bytes you can read. And say, oh, you can reach the end of file because there are no more bytes to read. But you can't just rely on this, how many blocks there are, and calculate it from there. You have to have explicitly specified. Now, of course, what's the relationship between this and the number of blocks stored? Well, that's a little bit funny. Remember the whole thing you did with
the last tutorial and assignment where you had holes in files. You had some files taking up. This is the logical size of the file. This is the amount of storage that's taken. You notice sometimes you have a file with a very large logical file size and taking up basically no storage. And similarly, you have files that have large amounts of physical storage, but the length is less than that. The size of it is less than that because of block. So the only reason why you get files that have larger logical sizes in Unix than they do have physical sizes. The classic reason is because of holes, which is simply an optimization to say that if you have file contents and inside the file it's all zeros, why store all zeros? Just say, these are blocks of all zeros. That's what a hole is. So some of these data things, like if this block was all zeros and this block was all zeros, why can't I just put a pointer and say, oh, it's of zeros. I don't need to actually point to a block. This is a zero. Save a couple of blocks of storage.
But think a little more sophisticated wise. Can you think of another way that you can make the logical size of a file be larger, significantly larger than what you would calculate from just looking at the number of blocks that are stored on disk for that file? What if the file system compresses? What if it's running a compression algorithm on all the blocks? It doesn't just store the data here, it actually stores it in a compressed form. So it might be able to take five blocks of uncompressed data and fit it down to one block.
What do you think of file systems that compress on the fly? Does that seem like an idea you'd like, or is it? It's good if it doesn't affect performance. So, do you think a compressed file system is always slower than an uncompressed file system? It depends on what's the ratio of speed between reading data in versus doing the memory operation, the CPU operation that actually compresses the data. It may turn out that actually reading from a compressed storage is faster than uncompressed. You know where this is really used? This is actually, when I say this, this is actually now becoming a much more common optimization. It was older operating systems have, older versions of Windows 95, things like RAM doubler. Hear about RAM doubler? So this was doing it in RAM, but you would actually compress parts of RAM so as to make it seem like, I have only, I have 4 megabytes of RAM, but I want it to seem like I have 8 megabytes of RAM. Run a RAM doubler. You have 8 megabytes of RAM. Not. It's compressing on the fly, and so it has a CPU impact, but it can make fit more things in RAM. Where you do see this in various places,
kind of compression stuff. Where you more see it nowadays is in deduplication file systems.
You know what I'm talking about? Deduplication? It's just saying that what if the file system notices if there's duplicate data on disk? Why store duplicates? Just say, you've got 5,000 files that all have the same contents. I'll just store one copy rather than 5,000 copies. Where do you think this could be really useful? Well, say any sort of cloud-based file system, like Dropbox, or iCloud, or Microsoft's OneCloud or something, or the Google's Drive or whatever. Deduplicating storage is potentially very useful because people will often store
the same files, especially if it's a music locker. You know, everyone has their own copy of a music locker. You might not be able to directly identify the files. You might even want to try to, but if you have a low-level system that's noticing, you know, underlying, you know, similarities, you can potentially just, oh, yeah, you know, these 20 people, you know, have 90% overlap in their music collection, so we only store one copy for all of them. Huge savings. So
why am I telling you all this? This is just to get you to realize that what is stored on in a file system, on a storage medium, is potentially completely divorced from what data, from what logically it is. And the logical size and the logical contents are not directly representative of what's here. And the most extreme example you could say of this is with special files.
Special file taking this all the way. It's saying, okay, you're accessing a file. What's the underlying storage of the file?
It's a device that's doing something. Especially with a character device, okay, it's just you send data to it, you read data from it. If you write data to it, will the data you read back from it be at all similar? Maybe. Maybe not. It doesn't know. It has no idea of the semantics of it. It's special. And thus the kernel can't assume it knows the semantics of it. Block devices, and this is particularly true for character, block devices, the kernel kind of knows what the semantics are. That's... it's a storage medium, and it does lots of tricks above because they're expecting a file system on top of it and whatever. But character devices, who the heck knows? For all I know, there might be a person on the other side. Who knows what they do?
So you've got special... So
what should hopefully be clear is that special files really are special and that they're all special cases.
All I can say as a general term is that there are block devices and there are character devices, but what the exact semantics of those files are is completely idiosyncratic. So what that means is I need ways of telling them apart. Of saying that, okay, this is a character device. This is a block device. What kind? Which one? Because it's not like they're all the same. They're all different. This is basically the category for the special cases. So I have to identify all the special cases.
So how do I identify them? So it turns out the Unix systems have this idea of major and minor numbers. Every special file, block device, they're two separate namespaces. The major and minor numbers for block devices, the major and minor numbers for character devices. But there's a special numbering for each of these files. So if you're wondering what the heck this particular special file is, you have to know what its major and minor numbers are. This is normally referred to as a class. Each special file has a major and a minor number. The major number is associated with the class of it, the kind, and then this is the instance. The minor number is the instance. So, for example, I might have a character device class for tape drives. And then the minor number will refer to which tape drive. I have a major number associated for USB hard drives, USB storage devices. The minor number says which one. On older Unix systems, these numbers were fixed in their assignment, and even today on Linux systems, a lot of the major numbers are pre-assigned. But nowadays, it can also be done dynamically. And we'll talk about that dynamic aspect after a couple minutes.
So try 921, so 925 or so, okay.
Okay, let's get started again. So, one way to think about file systems is that they're things that provide a file-like API. You can open the files, you can read from them, you can write from them, you can do seeks, you can do close. That's what a file is. It's something that you can access that way programmatically. Does that say anything about what's underneath it? Not really. And as you'll see next week, we can do all kinds of crazy things with the file system. But getting back here to special files, so you have a class, what's the kind of it, and then there's the instance. So another way of thinking of this class is which device driver? The class, the major number of a special file, tells the kernel, oh, this special file is for this device driver. And then the device driver says, okay, which one of my boys is this? Maybe it has only one, maybe it has whatever, but that's how it determines. This is for, the minor number is for the driver, the major number is for which driver. And then there's a separate set of major and minor numbers for block devices, so block device drivers and character device drivers. And then what that device driver does, I mean, that's a whole other separate bit of code. It can implement all kinds of weird logic and all kinds of lower level things for doing I/O. But the rest of the kernel just says, okay, you're a device driver, you're dealing with this, here you go. So in older Unix systems, Unix-like systems, you'd have a directory called dev. And dev stands for device. That's where all your device files are. So that's all your special files basically would live in dev. Normally dev was very big because you would create special files for every possible device that your system could have hooked up. Now in the days of proprietary Unix systems, there weren't that many different kinds of devices. There weren't that many device drivers. So it wasn't so bad because one company made everything. Whether it was Sun or Apollo systems or Unix or whatever. I mean, they all made all their own hardware, so but you'd populate dev with all the devices. But now you get into the PC world. The number of devices, the number of device drivers gets kind of insane. And if you start trying to manually allocate devices, even if you start trying to statically allocate major numbers, minor numbers, you're going to run into problems because well, traditionally, the major and minor numbers were all 8 bits. Now, the Linux kernel supports 32-bit device numbers, so 16 bits for major and 16 bits for minor numbers. But even so, it's still, it's better to make this dynamic. So what you really want to do is you want to be able to have, you want to have special files show up for whatever devices that are on the system, and only those devices. You don't want to have a device file exist if it does, like for example, if there's two hard drives on the system, you only want the special files associated with those two hard drives. You don't want them for 10 hard drives. Because then what happens when you access the other ones? You're going, oh, it doesn't exist. How do you figure out what's on the system? You sit there and you probe all the special files and send data and see, does it actually save it? I mean, that seems kind of bad. Actually, that's really bad because you don't know the exact semantic of the special file, and you might actually mess them up. So don't send random data to a special file.
You're reading them to do weird things.
So ideally, you want this to be dynamic. But now you've got this weird thing. You want dynamic, but these are files. Dynamic files. Two worlds, normally file systems are designed to be persistent. But this is dynamic, so. So what's the solution? Basically a virtual disk. A RAM disk. Or a RAM disk-like thing.
which means that the file system doesn't actually exist in any sort of persistent way. It's just a data structure in memory. That's changed. So when you boot up, this thing is created. When you shut down, it all disappears, and when you boot up again, it's going to be created again, and as you run, its contents will change. So there actually have been a couple of proposals for how to do this. There's this thing called DevFS that was used for a while, but then now they can the current one is called UDev. And so UDev is its own file system, but it is a virtual file system. And that file system is mounted by convention where? Slash dev. Where else would you put it? So it slash dev is a mount point. It's a mount point for the UDev file system. If you list all the file systems on a Linux system with df, you should see UDev listed. Slash dev listed as it of type UDev. And in that is where you've got all of these special files. And it's just the ones that are created.
And UDev is how their data
is stored. UDev is the kernel mechanism for doing this. But the kernel knows about, so there's these special inodes. Oh, so of course, what's going to be stored in the inode of a special file? Instead of having these pointers to data blocks, it'll store the major and minor numbers, and whether it's a block device or not. Block device or character device. So that's how this all fits into a file system, is that this inode is the thing that stores whether it's a block device, whether it's a character device, and what its major and minor number is. So it's all the same basic data structure. So the kernel can just look at an inode. What kind of file do I have? Oh, is this a regular file? Oh, no, it's a special file. It's a block special file. Oh, let me do this. So what's this UDev thing? UDev came out of an argument in the Linux kernel world about where to implement policy. So in operating system design, there's always this debate over mechanism versus policy. So when you say mechanism, it means the code and abstractions to actually do things. Policy is about how it should be. So in this specific instance, okay, I've got a inode, I've got a major and minor number and stuff and things. That's all internal and stuff. But what's the file name associated with that inode? What do I call them? I mean, if I'm going to access them, I need a name. It's going to be a file. What name does it get? You might say, well, we've always called it this, so we'll call it that. Well, let me give you an idea of how this is actually kind of annoying. On Linux boxes, the hard drives were referred to as HDA, or HD in a letter. So the first hard drive was HDA. So it would be slash dev slash HDA. The next one would be HDD, HDC, HDD. And you have partitions on it would be numbered after that. So HDA 1 would be the first partition on the first drive, HDA 2, second partition on the first drive, and so on. So you'd have these special files there for that. But it turns out originally Linux only supported IDE drives. So the older drives, IDE drives. So this is a standard for interconnecting hard drives to PCs. But there's this other standard for connecting hard drives to PCs, which was not so commonly used, but very commonly used on higher performance systems, known as SCSI, Small Computer Systems Interface. It's also used by Macs and stuff. So HDA was for the IDE drives. Different device driver, different kind of device things. So let's give it a different device name. So we'll call those SDA, SCSI disk parts. So SDA, SDB, and stuff. So now we have SCSI disk and we have regular hard disk. This is all well and good, except IDE went away. You might think, oh, I still have IDE drives. No, actually, your IDE drives are essentially SCSI drives. To the point that the same device driver, the same basic logic is used by that. So all your systems now actually have the IDE drives are actually SCSI drives in disguise. They did some things so that the code is the same. And so that's why on Linux boxes now, when you access the hard drive, it's SDA and SDB. Because the device drivers are all descended from the original SCSI drives. But they're hard drives. Why don't you call them HD? Well, that convention kind of went away. But it's like, that's just a convention. The kernel doesn't know. The kernel doesn't care. And what's even better is now you start using virtual machines. They don't call them HDA or SDA. They call them VDA. Virtual disk one. Virtual disk two. This is all confusing. What are you calling these hard drives? They're just drives, I don't care. But that's the under, you know, where does that come from? Those are conventions. That's policy. It's human stupidity. It's not the computer's problem. Just tell me how to name them. I don't care. That's what the kernel says. So if you tell, if the kernel's saying, just tell me how to name them, I don't care how, where's the naming? Do you build the names into the kernel? Because see, it was one thing when the device files were directly on disk. Then the system administrator, if he didn't like the names, just change them. They're on disk, and they'll be persistent. But now, if the kernel's dynamically generating these files every time it boots, I mean, these are pretty low-level things. They've got to exist pretty early on in the boot process. So originally, that they just built the names into the kernel. But now the kernel is specifying the names of the special files. It's specifying the policy. How do you change the names? You have to rebuild the kernel. That's kind of a pain. So the UDEV folks basically were saying, we're not having it this stupid, the kernel knows the name of things. The kernel knows no names. User space tells us the names. So UDEV is the interface, and there is a daemon in user space that reads policy files and sees, oh, when you get this device number with this sort of name and stuff, then you put it in, you give it these numbers, you give it this device name. So if you want to know how slash dev is populated, it's not populated by manually having, making files there. It's because UDEV makes them, and it has a policy file for saying how they should be there. Which the kernel can specify to something. You can, but of course, it's actually kind of weird because in kernel space, you can't also specify the file names. And in fact, I do that in the example. But I think what it is that the policy is that you specify the class name and the device name and you tell it, but UDEV can override it in user space. You want to see political arguments in operating system communities, kernel things. These are the things that flame wars are made of. Many flame wars. So why am I telling you this is because what you're going to see is when you install this device driver called dev1s, so this is the module I created you, this 1s module, when you load it, it will create a device file called dev1s. And when you cat dev1s, it outputs 1s. The character 1 repeated infinitely. As many bytes as you read from it, it gives you 1s. Not very useful, but there it is. So that's what you're going to be playing with and messing with. There's actually, a dev zero device thing, but of course that just gives you null bytes, not zeros, but this gives you ones. When you look at so you're going to be looking at the code, understanding it, you're going to be seeing these device drivers, but I've got to back up a little bit here. In order to understand the code, you need to know about two other things. Just enough time to cover. So slash dev in modern Linux systems is a virtual file system, which really is a window into how
the major and minor numbers of all the device files specified using this UDEV interface connecting to a UDEV daemon that specifies the policy of how they're actually named. Turns out there's lots of other ways that you find out what's happening inside the kernel. We went over slash proc, didn't we? Did we talk about slash proc? I think early in the semester. Okay, let's start with that. So in the kernel, in the Unix world, we want everything to be a file. Okay, everything's a file. What if I want to learn about what's happening inside the kernel? There's all kinds of state associated with the current operating system. Where do I keep that state? Now, on some systems, we would have, oh, there's a special object interface. And this object interface, you do this, and you request the object, and it's got all these, you know, properties and these methods for accessing, and then you could find out about the state of the system. That's not the Unix way. Following on the heels of a system called Plan 9, Plan 9 was the AT&T Bell Labs Unix developers creating a second system which more properly embodied their ideals after Berkeley messed it up. Because originally there was Unix. Unix was written for a single time-sharing system. Then it went to Berkeley, and Berkeley said, oh, let's implement this thing called TCP/IP on top of it, i.e. the internet. So they did that. And when they implemented it, they didn't implement TCP/IP as files. They added these other things called network interfaces, which had a whole different way of accessing them. That really annoyed them. They didn't like that. You messed up our abstractions. Everything was a file, and now this isn't a file, and why didn't you keep it a file? So they made Plan 9. They said, no, everything is a file. Even when you do networking, it's files all the way down. Modern Linux systems take ideas from Plan 9 and borrow them. And one of the key ideas they brought from Plan 9 was saying, how do I know what's running on my system? How do I know how many processes are running? What's up with those processes? You know, you have these commands called like PS that tell you things, or TOP that tells you what programs are running, but where do they get their information? Do they use some special system call to like get some specialized data structure where it has to parse through it and things like that? Nope. None of that. Files. There are files. Files mounted in a special file system, you know, mounted in a special place. There are, in fact, two of them in Linux. Again, historical baggage. Do you need two of them? No. But there are two. And why? Because first time through, they messed up. So second time through, they try to fix it. But you can't get rid of the old one because people are already using it. So you get both. And the two is slash proc and slash sys. Slash proc came first. Slash sys is much newer. Slash proc was this sort of general thing. This came directly from Plan 9 of saying, here is a virtual file system where I can look inside of it and look, see whatever is happening inside the kernel. So if you look in slash proc in a Linux system, you'll see a bunch of files, a bunch of directories with numeric names. The numeric names correspond to each currently running process on the system. So if you want to find out information about process 4724, look in slash proc slash 4724. And inside of it, it has all kinds of files. Files that tell what the command line of the file was, what its environment variables are, what its memory state, what file descriptors it has open. Anything you could want to know about that file is exposed in slash proc in the appropriate directories. It's kind of cool. It's all there. And you might say, wait, how can I access? I mean, does that mean I can just find about any process I want even if I don't own it? No. There are file permissions on the things. If you don't have the privileges to access that process, you don't have the privileges to access in slash proc. Same mechanism. So, but anyway, when you run top or whatever, it's just reading through that directory and parsing it in a standard way. And in addition to, so proc has things like
then there's like net. And so if you want to find out the networking subsystem on Elixir, there's some mem things, I think. There's devices. Poke around, anything you want to know about the kernel is in there somewhere. There's all these files that tell you things. Some of them give you all kinds of output and stuff. It's just there. And many programs go through /proc and parse things from there. Now, there's a fundamental problem with /proc, though. How do you parse it? Turns out /proc was really designed to be parsed by people. It was really more from the perspective of, let the kernel developers want to look around or people want to see it. And maybe some of it was like, okay, for commands that show you what running processes are, we'll create those files in a standard way. But a lot of the other ones were more debugging type things. Which means that when you change the kernel, you now have this issue that you potentially change how /proc is implemented. And you break programs because they expected the format of the data from /proc to come out in one way, and they added an extra space in a file or something, and now things break. So /proc is chaos. A lot of stuff are kind of the same, but it's chaos, and anytime you add new stuff, it's the weirdest. It's a dumping ground. And so the Linux kernel folks said, darn it, this is not a good, stable interface. This is not the way to do it. You don't just put random data in random formats, and it's all generally text, but it's all different. Non-uniform access. So what they did is they, let's start over. Let's do this right. Instead, we'll have /sys. In /sys, we will have keys, and we'll have values. The file names in here are keys. Well, the paths are keys, and they each have one value. And that value is at most one page in size, so basically 4K or 8K. That's it. None of this text files with all kinds of columns of information with different things. It's uniform. And so if you want to get lots of different values, you have lots of different files in a directory. So it's much easier to walk around /sys and access things programmatically because you're just walking a directory hierarchy.
You said each file is a key.
Remember, file systems are key value stores. The path is the key, the value is the contents of the file. That sys takes that to the logical extreme. It's a key value store. And the values are clean, single-type values. It's not. You never have to parse the output. When you read a particular file in /sys, you don't have to parse it. It's just, that's the value. Proc, you often have to do some parsing. So the idea is that most of the data that was in /proc that actually matters is moving into /sys. But it's this incremental thing, and actually they're probably going to keep both around, and that's probably not going to answer. Such is the nature of these systems. So one idea behind UDEV was that UDEV is supposed to abstract away the policy from what the kernel, there's the policy of how the device files should actually be named versus what the kernel thinks of them. But you don't want to just use major and minor numbers inside the kernel because there's too few of them. You really actually do want names inside the kernel because that's the only way you can allow for the space to kind of dynamically extend. You don't want to say, oh, well, who gets device number 247? And what happens when 247 changes? I mean, it's just annoying to assign numbers to these things. Have a name. So what you do is you have actually names inside the kernel, and those names inside the kernel can get mapped to other names in user space by using UDEV. But how is the UDEV daemon going to find out what the right mapping is? /sys. The UDEV daemon
reads in slash sys and can and uses that to figure out what the actual devices should be, and then can populate slash dev. The kernel can also put things in slash dev directly, but udev can override that and change it. So if you look in slash sys, there's a devices directory. There's in slash proc, there's a devices thing, which tells you what devices are there, but it's like a plain text file that just lists them. In udev, there's a devices directory, and it lists them, and then actually it gives each of the classes of all the different types, and it gives you all the instances. So it tells you all kinds of information about the particular devices. So whenever you see something in slash dev, there's also all kinds of things in slash sys slash devices. Actually, there's slash sys slash sys. Well, there's slash dev and there's slash devices. There's slash sys slash dev. I think there's slash sys slash classes. It's not something you look at normally, but if you walk around slash sys, you'll see them. And they'll. There it is. So the reason why I'm doing this is because you need this for your assignment. But that's why I'm mentioning this. But if you look around you, you'll see an interesting pattern of like, oh wow, there's all these things here, and then there's just one thing over there. One thing in slash dev, but there's lots of things in slash this. That should be about all you need. Oh, I'll end with one last point. Memory allocation. So memory allocation for this assignment, you should only be doing things statically. You shouldn't need to do anything dynamically, so I think you're safe there. But the thing to note in the Linux kernel, in any operating system kernel, doing dynamic memory management is tricky. Because if this is the thing that manages memory, and you want it to also be fast. So it turns out there's all kinds of different ways of allocating memory. In particular, if you're going to allocate things in single page sizes, a single page is easy to get. But what if you want a bunch of pages? There might not be any free pages. There might not be enough free pages for your request. Like, let's say I want to allocate a megabyte of storage. Say, can I have a megabyte? Well, maybe all the data is currently, you know, all the RAM is currently spoken for. You're in the kernel. So what has to happen? Something else has to, like, maybe get kicked out of memory. Maybe you have to swap some of the disk. Maybe you have to kill a process. Maybe you have to do something else. But what if you're allocating that meg of memory in order to implement those algorithms? This is why memory allocation gets really messy, potentially, inside the kernel. It's like, depending on what part of the subsystem, some parts of the subsystems, it's much easier. You can just kind of use the standard way and stuff, but you have to realize that if you use that standard way, you might go to sleep because someone else is going to have to do work before it is there. If you're a regular process, you don't care if you go to sleep, but if you're in the kernel and say you're a device driver and you've got like waiting for packets to come in and all of a sudden now you've gone to sleep, oh, whoops, you lost that data. You know, a gigabit Ethernet interface can have data coming into the computer pretty darn fast. So memory allocation becomes an art. And I'm not going to really go into memory allocation in detail in this class because it's just crazy. I just want you to know, it's crazy when you start looking at it. And it keeps changing. So be careful before you go down there. See you this afternoon.